My name is Darlene Christensen. Today we'll be interviewing Delbert Haywood. Welcome, Del. Today is October 11th, and it is 12th. Or October 12th, and it is 12:30 p.m. Today, I would like to talk about the environment that you grew up in. Because Southeast is one of the most beautiful places that I've seen, because I traveled quite a lot of different places. And one of the things that I would like to know is, can you tell me what you first remember about your environment from way back, from when you were small, what your first memories were of your environment?
Okay, we did a lot of fishing around the bay where Malachi was located. There's a lot of little spawning streams around it, all around the perimeter of the shoreline of the bay where Malachi was located. And I would say probably five or six different streams. And we used to fish a lot of these streams as a little boy. And the way we do it is we had these long poles. They put a hook on the end of the pole that was detachable. And then, you know, you normally put a hook at the end of a stick, like a hook.
Yeah.
Normally attached to it. Well, we did it the other way.
Huh.
And it fit in a little leather boot on the end of the pole, so that, and the hook was attached to a line, a ganyon line, and attached to the pole. So when, and it was fit pretty tight. So when you were either jabbing for a fish or throwing it, you know, like a spear, that hook would be backwards. So when it's going down into the water, it would hit the fish, say, on the back, and dislodge the hook as the hook sunk into that fish. And so the fish was actually, you know, on that little tether line that is attached to the hook, to the pole,
would
be flopping around at the end of this little pole, and just pulling it out. Sure, I remember that was the type of fishing that we did a lot as kids. Then the other thing, we used what they call beach seines. They're used in these little skiffs. And we used to row around a lot and pretend that they were big seining boats. And we looked the net out. There were small nets there, maybe 30, 40 feet long. They're built similar to gillnets in that they, you know, have a cork line and then web and then the lead line. But we'd hang them like purse line, purse seines, and then we'd pull the lead up after we surrounded the fish, and pull the lead line up, just like purse seiner would handle it. And then all the fish would be bagged up inside the net, which is the corks and the net in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And you bag it all up tight and pull them aboard. Mm-hmm. And maybe 10 up until maybe 100 fish at a time. Mm-hmm. It's time to get it set.
Another thing was, what kind of teachings did you have growing up about the plants and the animals and the environment?
A lot of it was just actually exposure, and then our grandparents, like I said, I spent a lot of my camp life with my grandparents. They did a lot of this. We went berry picking and went fishing like I described. They did it the same way. And this is where we caught our fish for drying, you know. And we set up camp right close to a creek and catch fish right, you know, right near the streams when the tide came in. But the parents, my grandparents, were the primary people that we looked for guidance, as you know, and then they were pretty mindful of, you know, because they were, they taught us to be thankful for, you know, all the food that came from natural life. So we had a deep respect for the environment that way. They made sure we understood that, you know, this they were highly religious, and they just provided by God, and that's where everything came from, that's what they taught us.
When you guys caught animals, like deer or something, you remember hearing stories of, did you guys have to do any different things to the animals, or?
Not that I recall. You know, I was, like I say, I left at a pretty young age and really didn't get into hunting all that much, you know, at home. But the only thing I remember is like when the men would go out, they would go out on maybe 2 or 3 week hunting trips and load on one of the fishing boats. They'd take a bunch of guys out, young guys out there and hunting groups. And they'd go quite a ways away from Little Catlin to common hunting, well-known established hunting grounds, you know. Different islands around there. There's a place called Duke Island, I remember, it's just island right next to that island where Little Cal is located. And hunt that island. They used to be a pretty favorite hunting area. There's just all kinds of deer there. And like I said, you spend a couple weeks out there and load the boat down with deer.
Mm.
And just gut it and don't skin it yet. And you leave and even lay the head on them. You know, that's all they do. Just gut it and take them aboard and bring it back to Metlakatla and then give it out to the people and just keep what they needed out of it. Mainly, we gave a lot of it to the older people that can't go out. And make sure they get some of it. But then, you know, that's when we share, you know, our foods like that. And we trade back and forth, you know, different. You know, some families won't get to go out for clams, you know, and then they'd be short in that area. And then somebody might have a lot of clams and not enough fish and some kind of bartering like that, you know, among each other. And so that way everybody makes make sure that everybody gets enough for what they need for the winter.
So, like, right now, if you thought back and you thought of one of your earliest memories and you look at the environment where that is and then you compare it to what you see right now, is there a change?
Yeah, well, a long time ago, like when I was trying to decide if I wanted to be a fisherman or go back to school, that was a big factor there. At that time, the management of the fishing industry wasn't adequate, I guess you'd say, that fishing game at that time. It was during the time when territorial days, And they really didn't have a handle on the problems. They seemed like they didn't handle the fishing industry. And what they did when, to try to get it back, there was a island that Ketchikan is located on. It's called the Village Gito. And the island is real close to the mainland, and you know, it's like the mainland wrapped around that island. And so you had a channel around it, all the way around it. And it's quite a big island. Mm. You know, take whole days to go around that, you know. And you go up through this channel. And in that channel, there's a whole bunch of spawning streams feeding that channel. And we call it Beam Canal, that channel. Mm. And when the fish started depleting, they didn't really know how to handle it back then. It was back in the 1950s, I think it was, and fishing was getting pretty bad. We weren't catching all that much, you know. It was difficult to make a living at it anymore. So our parents started saying, get out of fishing. Encourage us to get back in school and try to get a trade. But even then, I loved the game so much that I was willing to take a chance. But it turned out I did. In fact, when I decided to decide whether I go continue fishing or I go to school, I did it on a flip of a coin.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out school won. You know, so that's why I ended up choosing this direction to go. But, and I was just about the time I got married when that happened. I really had two kids by then. So I went to the RC Institute. You know. But what, getting back to that, what they did with that Bean Canal area, they shut it down. Fishing game as a kind of a desolate measure. Said, hey, we got to do something drastic here to try to revive the fishing industry. So they shut that whole area down from fishing. It was a spawning area. And so they shut the whole thing down for 40 years before they opened it up again. Actually, they never did open it up again. They just cut their clothes and just closed the day. You can't fish in those areas anymore, yet anymore. But the fishing that came in got bigger and bigger and bigger, you know. And pretty soon now, it's kind of turned around the other way, where now we don't have a market. You get all the fish you want, but we don't have a market. So, and then when we do have a market, the price wasn't very good. And so we ended up with a lot of fish, but no market, or you know, not enough so that's the way it is today.
So
when I went back there this last summer, and you look out in front of Metal Cattle, there's hundreds of fish jumping at a time all over the place.
Oh.
I never saw that when I was a little boy. So that's how much it rebounded from, you know. The other thing that kind of helped deplete the, and they outlawed them, was these big traps, floating traps. They're really a fishing way of catching fish. And they caught hundreds of thousands of fish at a time, you know, every day. And those tenders that went out to unload those traps, you know, couldn't hardly keep up with it, you know, there's so much there. But then, like I say, that diminished as well, you know, so they knew there was something wrong, and that's when they took the desperate measures to cut back on, or close off that one Bean Canal. That one move alone restored the fishing industry.
Hmm.
it took a lot of years not working the car. Of course, I'm on now. I'm working up here now, so, but I still love the fishing game. I still do even today. I'll go fishing, you know, even if I don't get paid, I'll just want to be on a boat. That's the way it is. I've done that several times, you know, with my dad over the years. I go down and spend a couple of weeks on the boat. I just want to be on the deck. You don't have to pay me, you know, they pay in shares. I don't need a share. You know, who getting paid don't get out here when I work. I don't want to take money from the criminals because the more and more you divvy up the money, the less and less each person gets.
Yeah.
I said, you just feed me.
Another thing with like the plants, when you think of the plants and the greenery from back then to what it is today, is there any difference in that?
Not really. You know, that that part of the environment stayed pretty level and never, you know, it had its normal ups and downs, but yet it's nothing that like what happened to the fishing industry. Same way with the animal life, it really didn't hurt that much, you know. There's still a lot of deer down there. Never over 100 to a point where you had to shut it down like they did the fishery. The one thing I did notice that was as an environmental change, the eagle population came back. That was way down, and in fact, the eagles for a long time were were put on the list of endangered species. But you go down the Haines now, where a lot of the eagles, I guess that's where they it's like a rookery, I guess. All kinds of eagles. I remember going down there this summer. And you look at Chilcat River where they gather just all over the place. I never seen that when I lived there as a kid. I'd never seen that.
Oh.
And now there's so much there. And you look at the around the county where I grew up in Nevada, in Mexicali. Eagles all over the place too. Same way in Sitka. I went there on the school reunion one time, and there was a lot of eagles there on the shore and in the air, all over. So that came back.
Yeah. Did you guys use the eagles for anything, or like ceremonial?
Right now, it's against the law, you know, to do that. I don't know if the restrictions they have on that, you know, as far as the native culture. I know it was against the law, and you'd be fined heavily if, you know, caught with just the feather.
Yeah.
You know, the means and stuff like that.
You remember using them long ago for anything like because of the clans and stuff like that? Were they like a sacred animal?
I told you many times I was without a, you know, culture for a long time, almost all of my life. So I didn't see any of that. I remember seeing other native cultures down, like the Tlingits and the Haidas. They utilize a lot of that.
Yeah.
But it does have I found out too, like up here, it has, even the eagle has a, like a sacred bird.
Yeah.
And I'm learning that it was that way in the Tsimshian culture too, when it was, you know, centuries ago when it was alive.
Yep, I found a picture of Metlakatla in like 1870s something, and it was just like a big place,
yeah.
Westernized already,
oh, yeah.
Stuff like that.
In the,
it's actually yeah. one of our textbooks. I just found that.
If you ever go to Metlakatla and you go inside of what they can call referred to as a town hall, it's, that building has been there for over 75 years now. And it's a multi-purpose hall. You have a gym in there, and you utilize it for a lot of different things, and different, they'll have banquets and things like that there. Yeah.
I didn't know it was all ready.
Okay, those are all gone now. Mm-hmm. All of it. You don't see any of that there anymore. There, this is back during the pre-Depression time, about 20 years before that, 20, 30 years before the Depression. So the economic climate at that time was real good. Fishing was real good. So there was a lot of that going on. In fact, when I was a young boy in Metlakatla, I remember a lot of two-story buildings, homes. You don't see today. And a lot of them are like just like this, a lot of the homes are just like that.
I didn't know it was so developed already.
Yeah.
And here on this page it talked about
the cannery. Yeah.
Duncan.
Yeah.
And this is in our textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was kind of interesting, didn't it?
There's a lot of painful times for all Native cultures back then, just like they were tied and they couldn't do anything. They were fighting. The prejudice was real bad back then.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the old timers would mention it. A lot of them, like my grandparents, they would mention it in the way they were treated when they were kids. And it was pretty rough. And then it was, I think my grandparents were the ones that went through the bad treatment of, in the schools, while utilizing their language.
Mm-hmm.
They already knew Simpson real well, and then when they went to school, they started banning the use of the Simpson language in the schools. Tried to get them to use English all the time. I suppose, it was the right thing to do, when you wanted to consider the fact that they had. You have to know English.
Well,
I used to listen to my grandfather talk, and he had very broken English. He didn't speak it too well. He used Simpson 80-90% of the time. I wish I knew it. I'm going to try to learn it, even at this late age. But I think if I spend maybe a year or two at it and really hit it hard, I think I'll be able to make it.
Yeah.
Because I still, I remember a lot of things yet, a lot of little phrases, things like orders, like the adults always do, get over here. Things like that. They're just like commands, really, and sent words, or like we're talking sentences and stuff like this. And there wasn't any of that hard. I was getting told short phrases. A lot of that we understood it when we were a kid.
Yeah. So, talking about like your personal, the way you see environment, the environment, what would you consider is your personal, like your ethics or the way you see the land, respecting the land, how do you see it today?
The way I feel about it is that, you know, I believe just like what the our ancestors believed about it. I mean, you know, it's got a, like a sacred, you know, this is where everything comes from. You know, that's the kind of what we were taught, you know, as you grew up. Show respect, you know, for the land, and it provides you with everything. You look at the materials for a house, materials, the food for the family and all that, you know, if you come from the, for us down there, from the sea, it comes from the, our homes come from the forest, so everything comes from the land. And we're taught to respect that. I remember my grandfather, when he would shoot a deer, he would say, "Thank you, thank you." And he was like, it's a prayer. And I read, he killed a deer, and he knocks it down. And he'd look up at him. Saying thank you. You know, that's something I never really, I don't know the real Tsimshian word for that. And you may not have, there's some word you don't have.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll use a substitute word, or, you know, try to use it for the same thing in English. It doesn't really have the same meaning. I ran into a lot of that. I remember up here in the, among the Athabascan people, the same way. There's an old lady that, pretty old now, she's in her 90s now. There was one of the co-works out of work asking, she thought I was, since I was married to an Athabascan, she thought I was Athabascan. So she asked me, said, how do you say, something, it was just a one-line sentence. What do you say this in Athabasca? I said, I don't know, I'm not Athabasca, I'm a Tsimshian. But can you find, help me find out? Because she wanted to, they were giving some kind of a party or something out at work, and she wanted the Athabascan expression for that particular sentence. So I called up and asked my wife when she knew down I met her, and she was, I forgot her name now, we called her Auntie. So there's a whole bunch of them like that. And I talked her over the phone, you know, from the house. And I said, how do you say this in Athabasca? And she said it. Almost like a story, the way, you know, on and on and on. It was a long description. Now, that's the best I can do. She said, can you kind of condense it, or, you know, break it down into something smaller? She thought about it for a long time. She tried this and tried that, you know. It was still long, you know. I guess she was trying to abbreviate it down, you know. But I don't remember what it was, because it was difficult to say the abbreviated form of it.
Yeah.
So, the structure, I guess, doesn't even match the way you structure things in English. A lot of times the noun and the verbs are all mixed.
Yeah.
When you normally say the noun first and the verb after, or something like that. That's not the way it's done in a lot of these native languages. I noticed when my grandfather would talk, or my grandmother would talk, the Tsimshian influence would have them say it in a different way. There was a lot of things like that when they were talking to us in English. You know that it was the format structure was in the Tsimshian, the version of the English language, and it was in the Tsimshian format when they talk English. So that's one of the things I think we're going to lose when a lot of the young people today that are first fluent in English and then they try to learn their native tongue. And it's going to be lost. The way they said it a long time ago. Could be reversed and take on a different meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I started noticing that. Okay, the next time, I guess tomorrow, we're going to have I want you to pay attention to one older guy there. His name is Arnold Bruce. He talks simply. He said a prayer in the Tsimshian.
Arnold Bruce?
Arnold Bruce, yeah. He's been a lot of help in recovering the culture. Elders have helped a lot in that. He's gone to the Canadian side and visited a lot of different people over here, all up on the coast and the inland and up in the mountains and up and down the British Columbia coast. Go back and forth and travel on the ferry up and down, talk to different villages along the way. Gathered a lot of recovery. He was one of the big movers in the recovery. When you listen to him talk, and you listen to David Boxley talk, in the sense that it's like the difference between night and day. If you're not familiar with it, and you know, somebody didn't bring it, that's why I bring it up now. So when you listen to him, David Boxley talk and you listen to Arnold Booth talk. It's totally, David's like David Boxley is talking Tsimshian with an English accent.
And tone.
Yeah,
must be
right.
The tone.
Yeah, you listen to Arnold Booth, he talks and goes up and down like that. And I remember that among the old people up there when they talk. It almost sound like they're singing at the same time.
That's what they say with other tongues too.
Yeah.
They say they're long ago how they used to talk with their tones.
Mm-hmm.
Now today it's fitting Western
mm-hmm.
tone of almost straight
yeah.
or like that. Or, okay, I think those were all the questions about the animals and the lands. Do you think they have rights, animals and plants?
What's that mean?
Do you think they have rights?
Rights to animals and plants?
Western terminology, but...
Yeah, I don't know that... You know, I never thought of it that way. Myself, I don't... I don't know.
Yeah. This is the first time I thought about it that way too. That's why I had to ask. Because in our class, you know, there's this whole push on the environment. How you treat the animals like they have feelings. Do they need animal rights?
I heard that too as well. You know, that... And one of the things that came up, I remember that, like the Eskimos would kill an animal, you know, like the animal rights people were very adamant about and against how the Eskimo people killed the seal and stuff at a club. They beat on it, you know. I don't know, I guess they got a point there to get, you know, this is... To the native people, and you know that's funny because they're trying to kill something they're going to eat.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's kind of sets the tone where that's a good reason to kill an animal, and then a lot of times you hear where natives say when they kill an animal. You're saying that animal's giving up their life for you,
mm-hmm.
to feed you. And I noticed when I was down in Minto, you know, they mention that a lot. Like when you go out hunting and you see a moose or something like that, and you say, they're standing there waiting for you to shoot them, you know, so you know that they're I don't know if they know that, but they know that they're there for a reason to, you know, become part of the food that they're going to eventually end up being, you know, for the people there. It's like a sacrifice, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, you know, like when I think about my grandparents, like when I told you that when we catch a lot of fish or we shoot a deer, my grandfather would dump them. You'd say it was like a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be his life for you.
Yeah. That's one of the new thinkings, like our new teachings, or I guess it's new to me too, because I never thought of things as having rights or like the animals and stuff. I always thought they were made for us.
Yeah.
And
the other breakdown, I don't know, you know, I heard that in the Christian arena. Maybe in the scientific arena too, they say, you know, we're born with the ability to, the man is born with the ability to think, to reason. Animals don't. If they're thinking at all, it's all instinct. Their survival is based on instinct. Where we as humans, we reason, you know, and we can figure out how to, since we don't have that natural way of, you know, we don't have the teeth, we don't have the eyes as strong as an animal is, you know, our hearing or anything like that is not as acute as an animal. I saw a documentary on wolves one time where they knew when an animal was going to be sick or lame. They can tell when an animal's old. They can smell. They can get down wind out of an animal. They can tell all these things, you know. Like if it's old, they may have bad breath, you know, from bad teeth, things like that, or if they're wounded, maybe they got wounded, they could tell by smelling the footprints if an animal was wounded, and they'll go track that one down.
Mm.
You know, based on all these findings, and they do like a survey, these wolves do. They know that they're...
So you think the wolves plan?
You know, you'd almost think that, you know, that's kind of what I think, because they're smart. When I go hunting, I ran into a pack of wolves one time. They were checking me out.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I was hunting moose down in the flats. I thought it was a pack of dogs, but here was a pack of wolves. Just in the middle of the day, too, you know, you don't see wolves like that. You know? It was tall grass like this, and the wind was blowing in their direction from me, and they were jumping up like this. A whole bunch of them, and they were looking at me. I'm about a mile, maybe a mile and a half away.
Oh.
They already smelled me, see? And I got scared because I heard, you know, a lot of old stories about hunting where wolves would pack and surround a guy. And he'd have to stay there the entire night. They wouldn't really attack right then and there because they, you know, they're afraid of humans. They know they have a gun, they know something in there. You know. But I've heard too, like I've read stories where that I saw a documentary one time on these big tigers in Russia that live way up in the north and it's real cold.
Oh yeah.
And those people that live there know that if you interfere with that tiger, in other words, if say that tiger killed an animal, and you as a human being came over there and tried to take that, or touched it, or did anything with it, that cat is going to track you down and kill you.
Oh.
It may take a long time, but they will end up dying. And that's exactly what happened in this documentary. This guy knew that he was targeted by this cat.
Oh.
And then he was an old cat because he got wounded a lot of times over the years. He got shot at and wounded several times. But that cat decided, hey, this guy's messing with my kill. And he leaves his scent there, see? He knows who this person is.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts planning, how he's going to go about tracking this guy down, killing him. Well, this guy knew that those kind of stories. He didn't, he was a middle-aged guy, but he thought he was going to get away with it. And when he went to this village and told one of these old-timers about it, that guy told him, get out of here. Don't touch anything in this house.
Wow.
He knew that tiger now was after him, because he didn't want his scent on that guy in any way to leave.
Wow.
But you know, I think wolves and bears and everything can do the same thing. And that guy got killed. Even though he had a gun, that tiger was just patient and exactly studied this guy inside and out for a long period of time. So they remember, with that in mind, they can think. They learned it instinctively or what, they know how to execute the plan that they're going to do.
And that must be why the animal rights people...
It could be.
push so hard on, on the rocks. That's another interesting part of classes here, because we get to look at things different and think about them. Because in our village, we just see things a way that everybody sees things, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like our environment and how we're taught. And then you come here and then, sure enough, you get to see how other people, maybe other people, why they come up with their facts, or
mm-hmm.
not facts, but their view of our life.
He also brings up another point. You know, a lot of these guys, especially among the white people that go out and just go out for the hunt, you know, that in itself is a big thing to them. It's a big adrenaline rush, I guess. And they think that, you know, as they go out, they kill a deer, or they kill a bear, or they kill a moose, or any big predators, a polar bear, and they go out there and you know, like in the moose, we go up and we go to these, I notice when we go down to Minto Flats and we see these white guys hunting down there, and say, oh, they're going to kill a lot of moose, they're going to kill a lot of moose, but they're not going to take everything like we do, you know, like the Minto people do. So then we go up to their camp and say, well, we'll take the heads if you don't want them, or we'll take a lot of the guts if you don't want them. A lot of the guys, those guys, it's, they're just there for the horns, you know,
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the head, so they can mount it. And they don't care, a lot of them don't care about the meat. And we leave word over there, so don't waste any of this. If you don't want it, we'll take it. That's what the Minto people say to them. Even leave signs down there in like boat landing and things like that. You know.
Oh, that's good.
But I don't want nothing wasted. And you know, there's a lot of the parts of the guts that that they eat that other people, even other native people, won't eat. You know, moose head, you know, it's, they serve it in the potlatch, moose head soup.
Mm-hmm. And the
brains. Yeah, it's just, yeah, that's something, and the stomach. You know, it looks like a big towel inside out. Clean all that up, and they include that in a big soup that they make. It's considered a prized. You know, all those guys that know how to prepare the soup, they know how to do that. You know, they make it the same way all the time. And you know, that used to scare me when I first started eating moose soup. I was reluctant to take it, but you know. But once I saw meat, you know, it was good. But just the thought, you know, it's a moose head. And the nose especially, because they cook that and that's a good to cube it up in a little chunks. Take them out.
yeah.
I don't anymore.
Moose tongue too.
Yeah, that's another thing like that. There's not very much. The only thing that, and a lot of times, we don't know. I've never seen anybody take the hide. But what they do is they, you know, whatever guts they left, they cover up the hide, that gut pile with the moose hide. Yeah, another thing they do is when they first get to move, when they cut the head off, they'll try to put the head pointed toward the village they come from. I don't know what the reason for that is, but that's one of the very first things they do. As soon as they cut the head off, they move the head off its side, pointed toward where they think the village is, where they come from.
Upriver from us too, they cut the throat and drink the blood.
I heard of that. Yeah.
And in my husband's village, they when they cook caribou too, they cook all the insides too, boil them, eat them with hot mustard. So I tried some of his cooking.
And a lot of the fat, you know, there's funny looking fat around inside the guts, around it, not in it, but around it. In the moose that they take off, and it's like all this fat is on a big membrane. And you take it out, once you cut it out, you hang it on the branches to dry it out. You take all the fat too that's in the guts, and you take it out and dry it out. It's one of the first things you do before you start really gutting the moose. Take all that out of that little gut cavity. And you watch them, people eat, they like to eat dry meat with fat.
Mm.
Just, you know, the fat you get from frying anything, the meat, you take that out. And they save all that, you know. Or you even save the bacon fat, you know, and they like to dip their dry meat in there, eat it like that. Just like we do with our olive grease, you know, we eat it with everything.
Yep. Make use of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, let's see, we covered the environment, animals, plants, long ago, today, and right into environmental ethics. And if animals have rights. Okay. So thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.